history professor in Washington, D.C. Woke History is a new podcast series that features lively conversations with guests focusing on historical and contemporary issues of race, gender, political activism, and culture that are often ignored in most high school classrooms and social studies textbooks. Guests will include a wide range of individuals from scholars and community activists to professional athletes, media personalities, and others. Today's guest is Mr. Andy Shalal, an Iraqi-American artist, activist, and entrepreneur. He's best known as the founder and CEO of the popular Washington, D.C. area restaurant and performance venue, Busboys and Poets. He's also the founder of Edenville, a restaurant formerly opened in Washington, D.C., dedicated in honor to the writer Zora Neale Hurston. In 2017, Mr. Shalal founded the Peace Ball as an alternative to the traditional presidential inaugural balls. He hosted the event for local activists at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Mr. Shalal also has a special interest in politics. He was a strong opponent of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. And in 2014, he ran for mayor of Washington, D.C. He'll be joining me today to discuss several issues, including his thoughts on immigration, the 2020 presidential election, gentrification, entrepreneurship in the midst of a pandemic, and the legendary poet Langston Hughes. Let's begin our conversation. Andy, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's truly an honor and a privilege.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I'm currently teaching a college course on American history before the Reconstruction era. And my students looked at the story of Alexander Hamilton this past week. As you know, Hamilton is arguably our most famous founding father presently because of Lin-Manuel Miranda's Broadway play. Have you seen the play already? Or
I am. Twice.
Okay. So I don't know if you're familiar with some of the music they have on the Hamilton mixtape. And you may be, but there's a song and a music video for one of those songs that I wanted to play a short clip from just to start our conversation. So
sure.
Just 1 second and I'll pull that up.
It's a hard line when you're an import, baby boy. It's hard times when you ain't sent for braces. Feed the belly of the beast with they pitchforks. Rich chores done by the people that get ignored.
So, Andy, I want to ask you, what do the song's title and that overall message, Immigrants, We Get the Job Done, mean to you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This I've used that line many times in many different conversations. And yes, this country was built with immigrants, unfortunately, slave labor, with people that have come from outside, sometimes by force, sometimes looking for a better world for them, for their families, and their future. And it's ironic that we are all of a sudden feeling like, all right, now we got to close the door and stop this this thing that really made America the place that I think a lot of people seek and want to be here. You know, I think immigrants and people that are marginalized come here work super hard to try to make it. And oftentimes I always say that immigrants are kind of the insurance policy for this country in many ways, because they come here with a specific goal in mind, and they know what they want, and they know what it takes to get here. Most people don't want to leave their homeland and leave their family behind and leave all the things that make them comfortable to come to a foreign country where they can't speak the language and they have to start over again. The only reason why they come here is because of the hardships that they are facing where they are, frequently due to policies that are you know, promoted or still by the U.S. and it's you know, reached throughout the globe. So I think when immigrants come here, when people come from outside, they want to make sure that this country upholds its standards, upholds its values, that they actually risk their lives to get to. And when those values don't get upheld the way they're supposed to, I think immigrants are the first to notice. We're like the canaries in the coal mine, where you immediately start sensing there's a problem and start raising the alarm and the flag. And I think we've been doing that. I think whether it's people that have been brought here by force or people that came here to find a better life, we have been the ones that have been able to point out some of the flaws that makes America, that can make America better and make it a more perfect union.
And you have a very inspiring immigrant story. Can you share some of that with the listeners?
Well, yeah, I mean, my family came here in 1966. We came here on a temporary basis, and we decided to stay due to the turmoil that was happening in the Middle East. I come from the Middle East, from Iraq specifically. And, you know, we decided to stay. And so when we decided to stay, you know, I, along with the rest of my family, made it our business to be civically engaged and be involved in everything that this country stands for, to justify, really, to justify why move, why come here, if you cannot partake in some of the things that make America the land that a lot of people want to come to. So, been here ever since.
Did you feel forced to, as you started to assimilate, did you feel forced to, you know, kind of forget about your past culture and, you know, the country from which you came, or were you able to still, you know, maintain that culture from your native land, but then also assimilate here within this mainstream American culture?
Well, it's really hard. I mean, when we came here back, that was 1966. I was a little kid then, and not understanding really how you fit in and where you fit in and all of that. And, you know, being a person of racial ambiguity, you know, not being able to fit in one camp or the other, and feeling very much like an outsider. That was really kind of the thought process that I was, you know, working within, is that I always felt like the outsider. I always felt like I didn't belong here. And so you start creating a world or a vision of America that makes you want to feel like you belong. And, you know, I've been searching for that belonging space ever since. And, you know, having mixed results sometimes, but really finding my tribe has been an ongoing quest. And finding the folks that I feel most comfortable with, the people that I can relate to, the people that I feel like I'm at home with. It transcends nationality, transcends race, transcends all these things. So I've always been looking for that place, that space. It's really kind of what motivated behind opening a place like Busboys and Poets, because it is that kind of place where it brings different people together under one roof that transcend race, that transcend culture, that transcend ethnicity. But it's all about humanity. It's all about creating a better world for everybody.
When you were a kid, because I know for a lot of us it's adolescence, it's so hard to figure out where you belong and, you know, fit in, right? So for you coming here, as a young person, did you tend to gravitate more towards like a certain group, whether it was your white classmates, your black classmates, other immigrants? What was that like for you as a kid growing up?
Well, you end up gravitating to the people that no one else wants to be around, you know? Okay. Because you become one of them, you become the outcast basically of the school, and so, you know, it was a mixed group of people, very very mixed, very, you know, different shapes and sizes and ethnicities and races and all of that. It was just like a motley crew And those were the folks that I felt most comfortable being around.
Did you grow up here in the D.C. area?
Yeah, I grew up in Northern Virginia and D.C., both.
Okay.
But mostly I went to school in Northern Virginia, in Arlington, right outside Washington, D.C.
Interesting. So how would you define the American dream, Andy?
Well, I think the American dream, oftentimes when people think of the American dream, they think of a nice house in the suburbs with a really nicely manicured lawn, a white picket fence, and a car, and I don't know, maybe two kids or whatever. That has never been the idea of a dream for me. I think the American dream is an idea. It's what Langston Hughes writes about. It's the dream that dreamers dream, where neither kings connive nor tyrants scheme, that no one be quenched by one above. It is a dream that is more of a idea, and I think that's what America is really all about. It is an idea. It is not a place. It is not a territory. It's not a physical thing. It's more of a really kind of a state of mind, and that to me is what the American dream is. Is that idea of everything is possible, that everybody is equal, that there is a sense of justice in things that happen. Now, we are far from it, clearly, but I think that's the dream. I think that I like to think about. That's the dream that Langston Hughes and people like him wrote about. And interestingly enough, I think even someone like Langston Hughes, who's a black man living here in this country in the early part of the 20th century, under the worst of Jim Crow laws, was able to see that possibility in America, which I find really inspiring, because it really does give you a sense of what's possible as opposed to what is right now, the moment you're in, which may not be the best. And that's kind of the dream that I think about.
You mentioned Langston Hughes. Folks in the DMV, and for listeners, when I say DMV, I'm referring to the Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia, surrounding Maryland suburbs. That's what we mean when we say DMV. For anybody who may be in another state or even another country listening to this podcast episode. So folks here in the DMV know you as the founder and owner of the Bus Boys and Poets chain. You had another restaurant, Edenville, as well. But I want to focus more so on Bus Boys and Poet. How did the chain come into an existence, and what do you want patrons to experience in your different venues?
It came into existence, as I mentioned earlier, for trying to find where I belong. And I really kind of, I wanted a place like this. I wanted a place that people come together, that they can break bread together, people from different backgrounds and different nationalities and different ethnicities, different parts of the city, can come together and connect with each other. Because I always feel like those connections make huge differences and can break down barriers that we imagine in our heads about what the other is and what it feels like. So I wanted a place that kind of breaks down all these barriers, that gets in the way of us becoming a real, loving community. And creating a place that allowed people to come from different ethnicities and races, where they feel they're consciously uplifted, a place that art and culture and politics can come together and collide in beautiful ways and create sparks and conversation, opportunities for dialogue, a place where people can come and take a deliberate pause and feed their mind, body, and soul, be able to write or read or connect with folks. I believe by creating a place like this, you can actually begin to transform your neighborhood, transform your community, and indeed transform the city and the world. So I think spaces like this are so essential for a democracy, for a place that is a public, space that people come to and exchange ideas and, have a glass of wine and have a conversation with somebody, that's interesting or that they may not meet in other circumstances. Oftentimes, I think when we go to kind of predetermined places, like if you go to a community forum or something like that, you tend to go with the group you came with, and you leave with the same group, you don't really get to interact much. And I'm not sure what kind of opportunities for growth or change take place in those types of venues. I think places like this that are far less rigid and more open, I think can allow for people's minds to kind of wander a little bit and let them see others' ideas and thoughts in a more open way. Maybe walk away changed, maybe walk away a little bit different, maybe walk away feeling just slightly, excited about somebody else's thoughts and somebody else's idea. And that's what makes, I think, places like this so important.
Right, and for listeners who aren't from this area, who don't know the Bus Boys and Poets experience, it's more than just a restaurant. As he says, it's a place where people exchange ideas. They have performances. Poets may come in and do readings. There's also a bookstore. The bookstore's in all of the locations, right?
Yes, they are.
Right. So why was that important for you? Because most of the time, you think people have a restaurant, they'll have their bar. They may have some live performances. But why was it important for you to also include this bookstore in each of your restaurants?
Well, I believe that knowledge is key for a healthy, thriving democracy. And to have the opportunity to learn, books are important for that opportunity. Sometimes we tend to, spend way too much time watching, cable news or listening to gossip or hearing things that may not be true. We've been seeing that over and over again in these past few years. And being able to make decisions on your own requires some basic knowledge, and books provide that. So not only do we have these books, but we also have authors that have written these books that come here and talk. So you can actually ask the author directly about what they think or some ideas that you may have not thought about. So I think, for me, having it's one thing to feed your body, it's another thing to feed your mind, and I think it's important to have both. It's not enough just to feed your body and have a nice environment to hang out in. It's also important to make sure that you also are feeding your mind so that you can stay an active and relevant citizen in a democracy. Because as somebody once said, democracy is not a spectator sport. It is about engagement. It is a verb. It is involvement, and that's what it requires. It requires an informed electorate. An informed electorate can, make a huge difference in how this democracy plays out. So I thought books and bookstores were terribly essential for that purpose. So the books we have aren't just ordinary books. You don't have, because we have limited spaces. We're not a full-fledged bookstore. We are a limited, unique, niche kind of bookstore. And most of the books that we have are all by and for people of color. And the reason why is because other bookstores provide all that stuff, right? We provide more of the marginalized voices, the voices that aren't oftentimes heard. So it gives a little bit of a counterbalance to the prevailing, mainstream barrage of information or misinformation we continue to get. And this is an opportunity for people to see things a little bit differently than they otherwise would just by turning on cable television. So it really gives a much more rounded understanding of the world, a rounded education about what's going on. And I think it makes for a much smarter group of people. That's good for everybody.
Right. And I know Teaching for Change was one of the groups that you Absolutely. Worked with early on when Absolutely. You were establishing the bookstore as well. And I know they do quite a lot as well in terms of activism, education. So why the name Bus Boys and Poets? I know you mentioned Langston Hughes. I understand the connection, but I'm sure a lot of listeners don't. So can you explain why you called it Bus Boys and Poets? And then also explain the connection with Bus Boys and then Edenville, which was a restaurant that you used to have as well.
Right. So Bus Boys and Poets was created to sort of give people, especially people that were moving into D.C., an understanding of the history and the culture that this city had. So Langston Hughes actually lived in Washington, D.C. He worked here. And he worked around the area where the first Bus Boys and Poets opened, which is at 14th and B Street, Northwest. He was involved with Howard University. He did a lot of, walking around here. I'm sure he went to the barbershop around here. I'm sure he went to see a show around here and so on. So for me, it was important to put that sort of marker here because a lot of folks that were moving in here were not seeing any history to D.C. because D.C. went through a fairly difficult period of riots urban blight. And it was making a comeback. And sometimes these comebacks tend to erase everything that happened before and kind of start from scratch. So a lot of stuff was happening that way in D.C. Buildings were going up that were named after like important folks from the Harlem Renaissance, people like Duke Ellington, let's say, who was a composer and very well known. So they would have a building called the Ellington. The area that's here was the epicenter of the Civil Rights Movement, and the street that the Ellington went on used to be called Black Broadway, which was kind of the heyday during the times of segregation, where the Black community was kind of forced to be in one part of the city. This was actually a thriving Mecca. I mean, there were stores and there were barbershops and there were theaters and there were bookstores and there were poetry venues and so on. So this was very, very rich place for interaction, commerce and people and so on. And so, to have a building go up named the Ellington, and then I noticed that in the building, they opened a tanning salon. And it was very odd to see a tanning salon in a building named Ellington on a street called Black Broadway. So for me, it was kind of like obviously a disconnect or trying to not necessarily erase history, but certainly not honoring the history that came before this. And so when I saw a building going up that was going to be named in honor of Langston Hughes, I wanted to make sure that, in fact, Langston Hughes had a strong presence here. So we created Busboys and Poets that became the venue for poetry and music and really kind of teaching people culture, African-American culture, which to me is American culture, but to teach people that and have kind of a way for people in a subtle way, not so subtle, but in a subtle way, be able to understand where they're moving to. A lot of people are moving into the city, not knowing much about the history of the city. And so the story goes that Langston Hughes, while he was here, was working as a busboy at a local hotel, and a very famous poet by the name of Vacha Lindsay happened to walk into the hotel where Langston Hughes was working. Vacha Lindsay is white and was able to actually eat at that dining room and was here for a poetry conference in the hotel, and the young Langston Hughes, of course, could not because he was black. But he was smart enough to put a little bit of his poetry in front of Vacha Lindsay. Vacha Lindsay read the poetry, was impressed by it. The next day on the way to work, Langston Hughes happened to pick up the newspaper, and on it, it said that Vacha Lindsay had discovered a busboy poet. And that was, of course, Langston Hughes. And he went to the hotel, there were people there taking his photographs. There's a very famous photograph of Langston Hughes standing with a full busboy whites with a tray full of dishes and a big smile. And this was kind of the way to present him to the world in a sense. Well, after that, he ended up leaving the hotel and went on to be one of the greatest poets in American literature and was able to make a living out of his poetry by traveling around reading and writing.
Interesting. Right. So, and then you had Edenville as well, named after Zora Neale Hurston.
Yeah, Edenville is the small town right outside of Orlando, Florida, where the young Zora Neale Hurston grew up. And Their Eyes Are Watching God, of course, one of her most famous books, was written about the town of Edenville. And there was an interesting relationship between Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes. They had a fallout over a play that they both were fighting over the rights to produce the play. And their fallout, unfortunately, kept them apart for the rest of their lives. And it was sad because they could have collaborated on some beautiful things. Unfortunately, due to whatever ego, whatever else happened, they were not able to do that. But I thought, well, this was right across the street from Busboys and Poets, and wouldn't it be fun to reunite them, in the heavens, so to speak? So I used to use on one side of the street, Zora Neale was on the other side of the street. It was a really fun restaurant. It was based on Southern cooking, being that Edenville, of course, was in the South, and was a great town. it was actually Eatonville has an important history because it was one of the first black municipalities in the United States. It was formed right after Reconstruction era ended, and it was formed there because a lot of black folks were not feeling safe being under the control of white towns, so to speak, and they decided to create their own towns, having their own sheriff, their own school, their own everything, to try to separate themselves from the white groups that were here that really wanted their demise. And so that was an effort and spawned many, many more black towns during that period of time where they became havens, so to speak, for black folks to be able to raise their kids, be able to send them to school. In a relatively safe environment at that period, when the Klan was, of course, at its peak and all kinds of horrific things were happening. Domestic terrorism was at its height.
Now I have another question in regards to the restaurant, but before I get to that, I do want to just ask you one thing that I should have asked earlier. So I know your family came here in 1966. Were you old enough to remember the 68 riots that occurred in the D.C. area after Dr. King's assassination?
Yes, I was at the time of the assassination, I was 12. It was life-changing for me because we were literally within a couple miles where all the streets were burning and there was smoke coming up. We were in Arlington at the time. You could actually stand at the top of the building we were living in and be able to see the smoke in the distance. There was a lot going on during that period of time. Absolutely. It was for me, I did not understand race. For me, I came from a part of the world where we didn't really deal with race in the same way that the United States dealt with it, and didn't have the history, of course, that the United States had with race. And so for me to be able to suddenly see that race was such a significant part of America, that was kind of a defining element of America. At that point in time, I started making my business to understand it better, to understand what was the cause, why were people so angry, why were people, rioting and looting and all of that stuff that was happening. And I wanted to understand it better. And I think come to realize that race does, in fact, play the most significant role in this country. It affects everything about this country, whether it's education or healthcare or policing or you name it, housing, who you marry, where you live. All these things mattered vis-a-vis race. And when we came here in the United States in 1966, you remember that actually was illegal in the state of Virginia for a black and white person to live or marry together. And it wasn't until 1967 that the Supreme Court overruled that, but it was illegal then. So it's not like ancient history. This is very, very fresh still today.
Yeah. You know, when you looked at the uprisings that were happening over this past year in the wake of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, and Jacob Blake, a number of people, there's that question, is it a riot? Is it an uprising? And, somebody like yourself who lived through the MLK uprisings back in 68, how do you define that? When you see these cities being, burnt, do you call that a riot or do you say that's an uprising?
Well, in the Middle East, where we work for is called Intifada, which is an uprising, basically. Okay. It's a shake-off. That's what Intifada literally means. You're basically shaking off the scourge of white supremacy, the scourge of history that this country has had. And I think due to the fact that this country has never really dealt with racism in a healthy way, it's always been swept under the carpet. It's always been couched in some kind of really neat language that keeps people more apart than bringing them together. And I think it has not been a healthy relationship with race. And I think it's time that what we're seeing is the outcome of ignoring a conflict. The major conflict in this country is race. It has been for over 400 years. And for us to ignore it over and over again, it's not helping. People think that by ignoring it, hopefully generation after generation, people will soon forget. But people don't forget that way. I mean, when you did somebody wrong, that gets passed on to future generations unless it's dealt with directly. And this country has refused to deal with race in a direct way. And I think this is what we're seeing right now, is that lack of dealing with it is what's causing people the anger to go out in the street and make their voice heard, sometimes in violent ways. I mean, that's how things happen. So yeah, this is it's been long time coming for sure. I thought it would happen sooner than this, but it happened. I mean, when we opened Bus Boys and Poets, one of the first things that I did here is started a program on race dialogue right from the get-go. From the first month we opened, we have this race dialogue that we wanted to have black and white people and others come together and talk about race. And people used to say, like, what's the obsession with race? Aren't you, like, making more of it than you need to? Especially after Obama got elected. It's like, can't we just move on? And it's like, no, actually, this is the moment that we cannot move on from. So I think, people that deal with these type of issues, the people that have their head to the ground, or their ears to the ground, know that it's not enough to just ignore it. You have to be in a real space of privilege to be able to ignore something as big as race in this country.
So in 2020, we were dealing with two pandemics. We had the racism that we were dealing with and the protests in the streets, but then we were also dealing with COVID-19. How did the pandemic impact your business?
Well, it had a profound impact, of course. Right from the beginning, it was like, wow, all of a sudden you're like, everything that we do here is turned upside down. I mean, we are a restaurant, and that's a high touch, high people kind of space. High interaction kind of space. You have, we have gatherings here all the time. So now gatherings are not allowed. You have, authors and speakers and panel discussions and all these things that happen. Now we can't do anything on stage. So all of these things were basically taken from under us, because of the of COVID. So we had to quickly rearrange, pivot, change, think differently. To make sure that we are able to stay relevant and sustainable. And we've been, knock on wood, fairly successful in that we've been able to continue much of the programming that we had done in the past, but do it in a safer way on Zoom and others. Slowly starting to reopen, the venues for smaller gatherings. Because I think, human beings long for being with other human beings. Isolation is not healthy for anybody. I know that, we have to weigh the health and risk and all of that with this COVID virus situation, but at some point we'll have to figure out a way to, come together physically, because I think most people really long for the hug. They long to be with friends. They long to be around people that they love or want to interact with. And hopefully that will come soon.
And you have 7 locations, correct?
That's correct.
So do you have tips for aspiring entrepreneurs?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there's always opportunities that lend themselves in situations like this. So different types of people are actually looking for opportunities to use this moment to be entrepreneurial, I've been approached by organizations that are doing, let's say, deep cleaning now, or people that have invented certain things that can kill viruses and be able to put them in your spaces, or the way that people are doing social distancing through plexiglass and little greenhouses and so on and so forth. There's a lot of different opportunities that are coming up. I think the key, though, is not to panic. I think that's the one thing that ends up to be the biggest problem. I think, especially for new budding entrepreneurs or people that have just started, and suddenly this rug gets pulled from under them. is the sense of panic immediately sets in. And when you panic, you start making decisions that may not be the wisest. So sometimes you gotta like not move too fast, not panic, and let it play out a little bit, because in a few months from now, things will get back to some kind of normal. You know, and I think I don't anticipate this will go on forever like this. Hopefully not. And I think we'll see that those that stay on their feet are the ones that are going to end up really reaping the benefits when things go back to some kind of normal. And those that panicked and decided to bail out may, you know, feel bad that they did that because they could have been part of this. So I you know, you have to be a little careful. Yeah.
Right. So gentrification is a polarizing issue in Washington, D.C. and many American cities that were previously majority black. In 2018, the local city paper published an article about your latest location in the Anacostia neighborhood. And I want to just read an excerpt from the article and then get your response.
Yep.
So it says, the question is whether Shalal's businesses can pay homage to black history and contribute to the cultural richness of the district without also leading a wave of development that negatively impacts black residents. Southeast DC resident Nicole Odom doesn't think they can. They want to move forward with this redevelopment, but it's not really benefiting my family, she says. We don't need a bus boys and poets. We need child care. We need schools. How do you respond to residents who see bus boys as a symbol of gentrification?
Well, we come much later after gentrification has already set in. So let me be clear here. It's not a choice between having busboys or poets or childcare. That's not the paradigm you want to create. That's, I think, what politicians would love for us to do, because it takes away their responsibility. You know, the idea that a busboys and poets, or any business for that matter, is the cause of gentrification is really short-sighted and misinformed, and really abdicates the responsibility of government. I believe in government, and government needs to step up to make sure that childcare, that healthcare, that schools, that all these things are run well. That is not to say just because we have good childcare, it means we can't have a nice restaurant. And just because we have a nice restaurant, we cannot have good childcare. That makes no sense to me whatsoever, frankly. I understand for people that are under stress and suffering and unable to make ends meet because of various reasons, I can understand they need something to point a finger at. And yes, it's hard to point a finger at government because government is big. You know, everybody points in the other direction, you know. But a restaurant is easy. It's right there. It's a billboard, right? You can point to it and say that's the cause. But what they're seeing is not the cause. What they're seeing is a symptom. When government abdicates its responsibility, when government does not fund childcare, when government does not fund schools, when government doesn't do the things that government is supposed to do, then you end up, you know, pitting one group against another. And like I said, politicians love that because that takes away the edge from them. They don't have to deal with it. They just say they point at busboys or they point at something else and say, oh, they're the cause. They're the cause. They're the cause. Without really doing the hard work, which is dealing with poverty, dealing with racism, dealing with homelessness, dealing with increased housing costs. Government can actually put restrictions and make certain decisions that actually make housing affordable. They can make certain, you know, decisions that make sure that they're the grocery store in neighborhoods that are food deserts. They can make those decisions to make that happen. It's not about a restaurant. It's not about one place, although that's an easy target. I do believe that sometimes you may have certain operations in restaurants that take advantage or are not there really. They don't provide a useful, you know, service to a community. People can ignore that. You know, if all of a sudden a very expensive steakhouse opens in the middle of a poor section of town, people aren't going to go out to eat there. So that place will go out of business, but there's a need for a place like Busboys and Poets, I think. And it's not just about us. I think like it because it doesn't have to be Busboys and Poets, that provides a cultural center. It provides a meeting place, provides it provides a place where you can come in and pick up a nice book. It provides a place where you can come meet somebody and have a cup of coffee. Whether you have a friend or whatever, I get far more folks that say thank you for coming there than those who say, you know, we don't want you there. You know, I think those are far and few between, frankly.
One of my favorite pastimes during the pandemic has been watching your Friday night Busboys and Friends Zoom dinners. You've interviewed everyone from Michael Moore and Cornel West to Nikki Giovanni and Angela Davis. I know you probably can't really answer this question, but who's been your favorite guest so far?
Oh, you know, I have to say all of these folks are people that I call friends. You know, we don't have dinner every weekend, but they're people that I can call on, and I really love them and appreciate them, and I hope the feeling is mutual. There are some highlights. I mean, I love Michael Eric Dyson. He's one of my favorites. It's always a lot of fun to talk with him. Michael Moore, I've known for many, many years. Angela, of course, is a very, very dear friend, and I've known her forever. Alice Walker is probably one of my closest friends that I know, and I love her very much. I mean, there are so many, honestly. Nikki Giovanni has always been so gracious. Her stories were so special, you know, and being able to have these conversations that are intimate and not always wonky with these folks is always fun. Tonight we have Imani Perry. I know this is going to be aired afterwards, but Imani Perry, law professor, I mean, law scholar and African-American professor at Princeton, is going to be talking about the election and her books and all of that. And then we've got Jose Andres is going to be next week, I believe, and we have Ilhan Omar after that. I'm very excited about the lineup that we've had. These are folks, anyway, that we are able to, you know, pick up the phone and say, would you please be on the show? And they're always more than willing, as long as their schedule allows.
I'm going to borrow something you do at the end of every episode. So, Mrs. Shalal, if you could have lunch with anyone, living or deceased, who would it be?
Well, it would definitely be Langston Hughes. Would be there at the forefront. I would also have Zora Neale Hurston. I would have James Baldwin. And I would have Howard Zinn. Howard Zinn, the great historian who wrote A People's History of the United States, and one of my mentors here in this country before he passed away a few years ago. He was always a very, very special person. I think Zora would add so much flavor to the evening. She's an incredible storyteller, and I think it would be really a lot of fun. I think Langston Hughes and his poetry and his ability to listen, it would be fantastic. And of course, James Baldwin, who's become everyone's favorite now because of his perennial writing, the writing that has withstood the test of time for many, many years, writing about race, about gender, about sexuality, about so many things that I think many people are starting fairly recently to really appreciate the contributions and his intellect. So that's those would be the folks I would have at my dinner.
So, Andy, we talked about a lot of issues in a very short time. My final question, the name of this podcast is Woke History. As an immigrant who has achieved so much, why is history important to you?
Well, you know, I think the obvious, obviously, is you know, we learn so much from history, and we see it sometimes repeating itself at our own peril. I think, you know, my eyes opened up to history when I read People's History of the United States, Howard Zinn's book on history. And for me to read a perspective of history that was a people's history as opposed to the history that we're oftentimes fed, which is the history about conquest and about, you know, countries and about generals and about wars, that doesn't tell you the history. What tells you the history is individual acts of courage that take shape to create change that I think at the end bends that arc of history toward justice. So I think those are the moments that I think give you a sense of hope and possibility. So reading about those moments really keeps you going. So sometimes I think you feel when you're in the middle of, you know, a very difficult situation, let's say what this country is going through, you think, oh, this is the end of the world and it's horrible and what's going on is the worst ever. Then you look at other things that have happened in the past and say, well, maybe this is not the worst ever. Maybe this is a process that we have to work through, and we're going to come out of the other end better than we were when we started. So sometimes putting things in perspective, history helps us to do that, put things in perspective so that we don't act rashly or in a panic, because sometimes when things seem darkest, they're really not as dark as we think they are. It's a process that we're going through to get to the other side, and we continue plowing through, looking for those moments of successes, looking for those moments of courage, looking for those moments where people step up and make that leap into the next level, that we keep bringing our world to a more perfect union.
Well, sir, this has been very fun, and I thank you so much for your time speaking with me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks, man.